the Living 1982 podcast. Were you into the punk scene in the very early 80s or someone who discovered the genre along the way? Well, we're doing some deep diving into the Seattle punk scene and sharing the story behind a band that was very short-lived but made a lasting impact with members going on to being in some of the biggest bands in the world. Their debut album was never released back in the day but is finally out now. This is the story of The Living.
On today's episode of The Living Podcast, we are joined by Joe Keithley, a.k.a. Joey Shithead, from the Canadian punk band DOA. DOA was the band during this era, and The Living band members have all mentioned that their show with DOA was the pinnacle of the band's short existence. Welcome, Joey.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Better than should be, actually. All things okay, good. I think I'm hanging in there pretty well. So the band The Living, I know you guys did at least one show with them here in Seattle. Yeah. Because my band was on that bill too.
Go ahead.
Yeah. And it was, I have the date here, it was June 12th, 1982 at the Monroe's Dance Palace.
Yeah.
And I remember notably for being a hall show that Dave Gregg lit his guitar on fire.
Okay. I do remember that show too. In fact, I dug through my posters. So I'm going to show you this, see it, but that's the show right there.
Yeah.
Monroe's Dance Palace. And the bottom of the poster is ripped off, but you can see the admission is $4.99. So was there some guy standing out at the door with a roll of pennies? Like, okay, yeah. Oh, don't forget your penny, buddy. Right? It's like,
yeah.
I remember that. Yeah, Dave probably lit his guitar on fire. He had this like Strat he kept lighting on fire. And eventually it got so dry from being lit on with this lighter fluid, because he thought, you know, he wanted to be Jimi Hendrix or whatever type thing. And in San Francisco, it was so dried out, it lit on fire that the thing broke apart. And people from the audience off that stage at the On Broadway started grabbing chunks of it. And then instead of Dave being cool, like, oh, yeah, you know, who gives a crap? He all of a sudden, like, please give me back my guitar. I need my guitar back. Right. And we all laughed at him. Like, he was the coolest guy going. And all of a sudden said, you sir, can I have back that piece? Right.
I'm going to need that this time tomorrow. Also remember, because before you guys went on, he's like, hey, can I borrow your guitar cord? Mine seems to be missing. I was like, oh yeah, yeah, sure, here. And then he hands me back at the end of the show this guitar cord that's all melted. It's like, oh yeah, sorry.
The other thing about that show, DOA, the Fastbacks, the Living, Monroe's Dance Palace, it was about 100 degrees, like something like that. It was just, I remember being the most insane place. The temperature was like crazy. But they had to keep all the doors closed because the sound in the area. So there's absolutely no ventilation in the place. I don't remember that, but it's just like, we had been in San Diego the day before and attended this like pool party, like one of these parties where we hopped the fence into a neighbor's backyard. They weren't there, and dragged me and some guys from Reno, dragged in a keg of beer we had stolen and dragged into the pool party. So by the time I got to Monroe's Dance Palace, it's 100 degrees, and I was holding my head going like, oh, God, I'm glad this is the end of the tour.
Jeez. Yeah, I remember it was blazing hot. There are some photos from that show that somebody has, because I don't have any of them, but I think I remember seeing them, and it was a, you know, makeshift stage, and when Dave lit his guitar on fire, he had already arranged for somebody to turn out whatever lights there were.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
So I remember it was, totally wild.
Yeah, it was out of control.
As things were, as things tended to be back then. But, I know that Duff from The Living, was pretty much, he's always said that DOA were kind of his, you know, like every position of DOA was something that he was going for. You know, the Randy Rampage, you know, he wanted to be Randy Rampage on bass, absolutely wanted to be Chuck Biscuits on drums,
right.
And then ended up being, you know, guitar player, singer too, in tribute.
Yeah, to no, that made, yeah, no, that's great. You know, it's great that DOA can be influenced on somebody, on people that have done great in music, right? So that's a cool thing. Yeah, definitely, Randy was an influence that people just looked at him because he was like crazy, out of control, dyed blonde hair, bass player spinning around and smashing his guitar and stuff.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting. I was also just thinking sort of that maybe the original DOA lineup could have been, you know, one of the, like, you know, of course, in the arena rock, you know, scene, there was, you know, all people in the band were, you know, like these mega stars and stuff like that. But like, I sort of like the DOA was almost like the Who in a way that everybody was, you know, like, you know, everybody was absolutely notable, you know, like. It was just like, you know, your snotty singer and a guitar player that just stood back there and a bass player that barely played and a drummer that just, you know, like a lot of
yeah,
punk
right.
bands just learning to play. And, you know, everybody was a little bit, you know, they tried to sound good and stuff like that. But it seems like when DOA started coming down here and people were watching you guys, it was. You know, it's sort of what everybody wanted. You know, there was never anything boring about it. There was never, nobody was ever like taking it easy. You know, nobody was ever sitting back and in anything. And then with Dave Gregg, then you had the, you know, the stripy shirt, you know, lead guitar player who, you know, was out there, you know, doing that. And
yeah,
I hadn't really thought of that before. Just
yeah, no, Dave is great.
It was sort of like the punk rock, the Who, and still is.
Yeah, it's kind of a great, great combo of characters. That's for sure. I mean, Chuck, Randy, and I held together for about 4 years, and then it wasn't long. Randy left early 82, and then Chuck like not too long after that, right? But you know, Dave stuck with me for about 8 years or so, right? So, you know. You know, DOA's, I think DOA's been through, I think we counted up like 30 members. Now, you know, they're current. Some people say I'm hard to get along with, but they're fucking nuts if they say that shit, right?
I'm gonna kick them. I'm gonna kill them. I'm gonna kick their ass. Not fucking nuts. Regular.
Yeah. Well, it was a real accident that DOA even happened in the first place because the way it worked, I guess, a real quick thing that, I came back from Toronto. I had a band called The Skulls. We broke up. So beginning of 78, I put an ad in the paper. That's who was looking for a drummer and a bass player, punk rock band. And Randy came along and tried out as a drummer. And he was okay. And I thought, well, okay, it's not bad. And then Chuck, who was dealing with Slow Bird, came along and he was just like, wow, okay, this guy's got to be great, right? And of course, he turned out to be one of the best all the time. And then I thought, I bet that Randy guy, well, he knows rhythm. I can teach him bass, right? And I grew up as a drummer. So DOA started with three drummers. That was kind of our, the rhythm boys or whatever.
Right. And a you know, very good background for, you know, playing music. If everybody has at least a knowledge of what it's like to play drums, then.
Yeah, even if you can't do it, totally top notch. I mean, that's why I became a guitar player, because I played with grew up with Tim Wood, Chuck's older brother, and we were both drummers. Then after a while, it was clear he was a much, 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 much better drummer than I would ever be, right? So at 18, I picked up a guitar. I thought, I'll never be in a band if I, you know, I'll get kicked out, and then I'm just an unemployed, useless drummer, right? So.
Right, I'll just start my own band and play guitar, and so I'll show you guys. Well, then I start thinking the first time I saw you guys was at the Bird in 1978. It must have been.
Yeah, because we went to Mabuhay, our first road trip, I think in June 78. And then on the way back, we got a show with the Enemy.
Yeah.
At the Bird. Yeah. And, which I guess kind of them and the Lude would be Seattle's first two punk bands, I think.
Yeah, pretty much. Correct, I mean, there was, you know, like, it depends on how hard you dig, you know, you could say, and what you consider a punk band. I mean, there's, you know, like the Telepaths, you know, like, but right. But definitely the Enemy were the first band to really go for it. And they started a club, right, and they did it. I mean, they got other bands. They went the extra mile. And you know, got something going. Which
they had that. Was their manager that Robert guy? Robert, or is that the Lude's manager?
That might Robert Bennett, I think, was his name.
Yeah. Okay.
No, I don't. The
yeah, Roger, maybe they weren't connected, right? Yeah. Yeah.
The Enemy's manager was Roger Husbands, I think, who was also the manager or the guy that ran the Bird, the rock club.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. I think he gave us $25, so it's better than nothing.
Well, we were like, oh, who's this band called DOA? And they came across like, you know, oh, well, these guys think they're pretty tough. And so like originally, like the first couple songs were like, wow, this we're not quite sure about this. And then instantly we're like, fuck, this band rules. And you know, like from then on, it was like, wow, you guys great. And I bought that first four song EP.
This just sucks.
When you guys had a little box of those in the back room where they had the popcorn and stuff like that at the at the Bird. And from then on, I were just, you know, just great, just super fans basically.
Right.
But I think one of the things that that, you know, the I mean, you guys really did it. You booked the tours. You did things that so many bands only wish they could do. You know, right, back then, I think that's what sort of, you know, that's what sort of happened is people looked up to you guys because you'd go on tour, and not only, you know, you do shows, you do hall shows in Vancouver, which we went to. But you play bar shows too. You like sort of did everything. You know,
there was no kind of holding back. We were predetermined. We got out the Disco Sucks single probably about June 78. And I remember I took those things and I mailed them to magazines and clubs with a little letter said, "Hi, we're a punk rock band from Canada. Can we come and play in your town?" Right, and then we wait for a letter to get back. Sure, you can come and show up. Right, so and that's sort of the way I became unafraid to phone people up and go like, oh hey, we'd like to come and play. Right, you know, I didn't know anything about money, so we generally played for nothing. Right, you know, or maybe like food or something like that and some beers, and we just you had to be to really take the initiative, and I found that I found a like-minded guy. That we exchanged a lot of notes with, which was Chuck Dukowski from Black Flag, right? Because we got to know them really early on, right? Like playing down in LA by early 79. And so Chuck and I would exchange numbers. So, oh, don't go to that place. That guy will rip you off, right? You know, no, this is what, go here. You'll get $100 or whatever, right? And we just sort of, so we did it off. Crossing like on North America, as obviously Black Flag, they were like completely determined as well to, you know, pulling a trailer behind them and just going getting it done. I mean, I'm meeting a lot of people, I mean, and making a lot of friends over the years. I still have, right? Not all of them, but you know, a lot of them.
And you know, I think, you know, that was just great. And then the show in June 82 down here at the Monroe's Dance Palace, it was Phil Spectacle put that one on too.
Yeah,
which, you know, it's just I didn't think about it back then at all. It's like Phil's like, oh yeah, I'm doing a DOA show. Do you want to be on the show? Sure, sure. then you start thinking about, it's like, wow, he was putting on shows in Seattle, in a different country, you know.
Yeah.
You know, like, and we played with you guys up in Vancouver, maybe the Arcadian Hall.
On Main Street and Six, I think.
Of course, I remember the poster for that too. It was DOA Fastbacks and the Silly Killers, You know, and their singer was not present for the show. And just remembering these things to think of, like, what if I wanted to put on a show in Vancouver? I'm going to call a hall. You know, this wasn't a place that had rock shows. You know, just a place, you know, that you'd rent for
a dance. Monroe's Dance Palace. We went there and we looked at the name. What's the next show? Monroe's Dance Palace. We're like, okay, that could be great, right?
Yeah, so. that sounds just
great. Yeah, that was great. I found another one you might remember here. It's back from the Metropolis. So I don't know if you went to this one. I'll hold it on. DOA, Poison Idea, The Farts at the Metropolis.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's 82.
Be 83. I think the Metropolis might not have actually started till 83.
Right. I see the tickets went up. Monroe's Dance Palace was $4.99. This one's $5.50. So 51, they've gone up by 51 cents. So maybe you can judge it from that, right?
Because price, you know, your fee had gone up, 10% at that point. Now, instead of having a bunch of pennies to throw at the band, then there was actually two quarters that at least everybody had that they could throw at. Well, all those bands were pretty tough at that point. There was nobody was probably going to get stuff thrown at them. At that point. But they're good. If it was the Farts, were they still going in 83? I guess.
Well, it just, I mean, I'm glad to hear it. It's like DOA, Poison Idea, and the Farts, right? I guess so. I don't totally remember, but they must have been. It's Sunday, August 1st, 82, I'm thinking. I've got in the back of this poster, it's 82, but I could be totally wrong.
That would make more sense, because the Living, after they sort of split up, they and some of the Farts members started 10 Minute Warning.
Yeah, right, okay, yeah.
And there was, you know, there was appropriate to this this discussion, there was, you know, some combination of band members and people, you know, going from one band to the other. And to think of that was kind of a sign of the times, maybe particularly in 1982, you know, it just seems like everything was sort of getting shaken up. And, you know, maybe at least in Seattle, a bunch of people are probably getting tired of playing the same, you know, shows in the same places. And, you know, by 1982, nobody in Seattle was getting anywhere, really. And so it may have, you know, sort of just kicked some people into gear to get bored of their band that they were in, or to, and it's like, okay, well, I'm going to do something different. I'm, you know, this isn't working for me. I want more than what I'm getting, you know. And because it almost seems like throughout 1982, tons of bands in Seattle were changing members, and they play for 6 months and, you know, make a drastic change and have a new name. And people were just doing kind of anything they could, you know, probably seeing, you know, bands like DOA and the Subhumans actually out there playing and touring and doing the things that everybody wanted to do, but not being able to do that themselves, because maybe there was one person in the band that was a fuck up and made it so you couldn't do anything, or, you know, people had different ideas about what kind of music they want, you know, like all the normal things. But, you know,
I think one thing there, Kurt, that, okay, so I started playing punk rock in 77, as I'm sure there's punk rock in Seattle probably in 76, early 77, right? You know, Ramones came to town, I think early 77 came to Vancouver, like on their first album. Maybe that was 76 we saw them. And but the first 4 years we had all our early bands, like Subhumans, Dish Rags, Point of Six, DOA, The Modernettes, Young Canadians, kind of the core of the scene bands that you know people still kind of remember, right? And but by you're kind of right in the sense by about 80, late 82, 83, a lot of people started splitting up and the bands started breaking up, right? The Subhumans were pretty well done. Point of Six were in almost in complete disarray. And the other Bankrupt bands were definitely broken up. They tried to move on, some starting new bands, right? So which were successful or unsuccessful. But yeah, and it was kind of one of those things that if you didn't get out of town and play a lot, then the momentum stopped.
Exactly.
So just to your point, there was like that, like, what the hell am I doing this for? Like, it's my same 50 drunken friends every time, every 2 weeks we play down the whatever hall or, you know.
Right. And that's fun and everything. But especially if you're, you know, in 1982, I was 21. Duff was 18.
Right.
You know, you're just like, that age, I mean, it's just like, it's fine playing the shows that you play for whatever reason, but then you see people getting something more, you know, they're getting out there, they're playing shows up and down the coast. They're, you know, just doing more, just getting things done and making records and making records that sounded better. And, you know, and all those things. And it's like, well, these, you know, these guys aren't really doing that. You know, what can we do? And, you know, oh, well, this guy in this band is really gung-ho and ready to, you know, take it to the next level. You know, so people start rebuilding their things. And then, of course, a lot of bands, it sort of loses, you know, getting all the ambitious people together, you know, maybe sort of possibly could lose some of the initial kick-ass factor of just a bunch of weirdos getting together and playing killer music as fast as they can. But you know, like I was just thinking, like, you know, like the hardcore scene, you know, probably when was hardcore 81? What month was that? Do you remember?
February. I'm just working on that because it's the 40th anniversary. So it's kind of being reissued in August of this year. But it was out by February.
February 81.
Yeah, February 81.
And we all went up to those shows.
Yeah, we had two nights with Black Flag, and 7 Seconds was supposed to be there, but they didn't make it. They came with another form, right? Yeah.
And, you know, just thinking sort of 81, 82 into 83, you know, the hardcore scene was you know, kind of getting going. And then, you know, maybe by 83, 84, that started kind of burning out a little bit. And so many of those bands started playing, you know, slower music and hard rock and having big hair and frizzy, you know, like LA sort of style. Just sort of thinking of the, you know, the natural sort of progression. It's like, well, all these metal bands are playing and all these girls are going to see the metal bands. Whereas, you know, the hardcore bands were, you know, not only dudes, but you know, it was heavily dude oriented sort of scene. And, you know, and which in some ways, you know, made for some interesting music, but at the same time, you know, a lot of those bands kind of lost their killer edge, I think.
I would agree. It transformed you because the hardcore scene got more metal. And also, like, kind of got, like, a bit more of a skinhead element in it by, like, 84, 85. And which, you know, started to make it not fun to go to shows.
Like right. I mean, that was the thing about hardcore shows. About 83. Shows.
Yeah.
Hardcore shows, even if, you know, everybody's got their elbows up and, you know, like, it's like, just put your elbows down, you people. Yeah. Elbows down. Okay, we'll start this one. But at least it was always seemed like it was fun. And then you get these sort of drunken skinhead, you know, people who are actually angry, you know, and yeah. just would go to shows just to start fights and stuff like that. It's like, well, no, that's not really what it's for. It's yeah. fun to, you know, listen to fast music and, you know, have a wild time, but, you know, people that are just, you know, just looking for a reason to start trouble. It's like, well, that's just stupid, you know.
Yeah. And then it stopped punk rock from being fun. You know, it kind of by 86, 87, I mean, a lot of people weren't going to shows at all. It just went like, I'm done with this, right? So, and then, you know, then it changed. And then, and like going back to an earlier point you made, when people sort of tried to make a more hard rock scene, you know, from their previous punk bands, which is, to me, is fine for people who play different music, but it usually makes more sense if you change the name of the band instead of trying to use your past success. It'd be like, you know, if DOA had become like that kind of
Ring band. Rock, man.
Oh yeah, old DOA fans would have gone like, who the fuck are these guys, right? Like, you know, these guys used to be good. They suck now. You know, I mean, see, it's really a difficult thing because people want to progress in music, or they want to get successful, or they just want to have fun. Like you said earlier on, that's some of the great magic, the early punk rock, that it was just, you could have three or four just crazy, bizarre people that just happened to meet, and all of a sudden they made a great fucking band, right? And those elements you can't replace. Even if you got somebody who's maybe a better player or like more pro or whatever, that kind of
right,
thing.
Right, for sure.
It just, the magic of that kind of just weird approach, all of a sudden it was, the band lost it, right? Or at least part of it sometimes, right? So, you know.
But, you know, I do sort of think that 1982, at least in Seattle, things were, you know, turning, and that's why that the band The Living, I believe, probably started in about later 1981, and right. you know, how far into 1982, I was still trying to find the date that this recording was made, you know.
Yeah.
Just because even from month to month, just looking on the Fastbacks gig calendar and stuff like that, it's like, wow, you know, so much changed from month to month. You know, it was just everything was just flying around, and you know, just young people on fire, I guess, you know, just getting bored and wanting to do more. And it's like, oh, this is stupid. I'm getting out of this and stuff. So it's just fascinating. You know, I still don't know exactly what day it was. Have you heard this recording? The Living?
I've listened to parts of it. I was listening to the, I guess it's the single today.
This
video I watched. I watched on YouTube. It was cool. It was pretty funny. I don't know where they dug up all that old footage, but with the crowd, like the band was pretty, a little bit hard to see for sure, but the crowd stuff up close was like pretty rich, you know, because like, I just think like, way, you know, the way punks look now and the way the punks look then, it was just a pretty interesting cross section, because you had a lot of people that would show up at shows, and their brother told them, oh, these guys are cool, and they show up, right? And then all of a sudden it's their first exposure. It's just, I'm like, wow, like crazy band, right? So yeah, I mean, the record sounds good. I mean, what's like 8-9 songs or so?
I think it's just 7. It's about
you know, okay. Yeah, yeah.
15 minutes.
Hey, that's all you need. Right? I mean, no, it's good. Didn't the Farts do like the first EP was like 19 songs on a 7-inch? They're like, that's about 14 minutes long or something, right? You know.
Yeah, yeah. Better than 14 or 15 minutes of good music than 38 minutes of non-good.
Well, it was my favorite title and cover all the time, because this world fucking stinks, right? So every time I look at that, I laugh, right? It's just like, you know,
Oh yeah, and we did, that was at the Gorilla Room, DOA Farts Fastbacks, whatever that had to have been 1981 for sure.
Right, and because there's two places. There's a Gorilla Room that we played with you there, but later on we played again at Gorilla Gardens, which is totally different.
Yeah. Which was, you know, maybe the same person presiding over it, but yeah, they were very different. The Gorilla Room was just a little tiny bar downtown.
I 81. Okay, that show. The last song of their encore, I fell off the stage, and I end up with like a walking cast, and that was the start of the Hardcore 81 tour, was the start at the Gorilla Room in Seattle. So that was probably like April 1981. So I ended up with a walking cast for about the next six shows. I had to sit down on a stool. So we just put Randy in the middle to entertain people, and then it worked, right?
Well, I guess I got, you know, show must go on.
Yeah, well, you know, Kurt, I've been around long enough show business. I did my training with P.T. Barnum, and later on I worked with Jack Benny and Vaudeville, right? That's how I know all this shit, right?
Yeah, I learned with some of the best.
Mr. Barnum. The skills to work my way down, right?
Yeah. Jack Benny, he had the best, book of rules in the business. I'm also thinking of, how did you hear of The Living? Like, I know that there was that.
I don't think we really did till we arrived at the show, right?
Yeah.
We knew Duff, of course, right? So I obviously, here's a new band type thing, right? So cool. It's like, it was just one of those things. Back then and to this day, I was always been kind of like, people go like, who are we playing with tonight? I'm like, I don't know. We'll find out when we get there, right? So it kind of goes with our old mantra. A lot of times we didn't know the directions or the address of the club, and our old manager would go like, me and Randy would be driving, and we'd go like, okay, so what's the address? He says, I don't know. I just drive into town and look for punks. Right? And that was our modus operandi. So we did get them on those dance fellas, and we knew the address, but we looked for punks and they were there, right? So
just look for all where all the punk kids are hanging out. That must be our show there.
Yeah, it was kind of like an odd location too, wasn't it? It was like
It was sort of near Queen Anne Hill, which would not be the first choice of a location for a punk show. But it was up a driveway, and you know, like I had to drive up sort of a gravel road a little bit. It was sort of in the middle of nowhere, you know, in the middle of the city for sure. But it was a place that you couldn't see from the street. So I could imagine anybody would have a hard time finding it. And I think, you know, there were a few punk shows that were put on there over the years, but it was never a hangout. It was never a known.
So it was just an odd location. I just remember it being all in all like a good show, except for the fact that it was like 110 degrees.
Except it was a sweat fest. And then, you know, I was also thinking of the, back then, you know, we were all turning 21, but the Fastbacks, not everybody else. We used to come up to Vancouver all the time to see not only the hall shows, which, you know, oftentimes we'd be on the bill or our friends would be, but also to go, and it's something that we didn't have, something that didn't work the same way in Seattle. We would have hall shows, but we didn't have a place like the Smiling Buddha, you know, that had, you know, proper, you know, rock shows and an okay sound system. And the fact that we could get in, you could get in before you're 21. And of course you had to be 18. And there was a few times that some of our friends who were only 17 would come up with us to go to the Smiling Buddha to see some shows and had to wait out in the car. It's like, I mean, what was the guy's name? Igor, the door there, right?
Igor, the doorman, who's like 6'5" and 300 pounds. And he filled the entire door.
No,
mainstay. Yeah, no ID, no entry. Yeah, he was a Croatian guy, right? And Igor is great. Hey, I guess, well, you guys kind of missed out because me and Rampage had this scam at the Buddha, because when we would play there, it would always be sold out, which wasn't much, like 105 people was the occupancy. And then Lashman, the owner, would look at me and go, "Joey, too many people. I went, "No, okay. So then I'd say, "Randy, you go around the back, and anybody who can't get in, tell them go around the back, collect $2 each off of them. And then then there was a way you could look from the back door down to the bar. And I would wait till Randy and Garrison people, I'd look down and see if the bar people were looking. And I'd open the door and Randy would grab all the money off these guys. And 10, 20 more people come in. And then we'd wait like another 20 minutes. And then Randy would go around the back, collect the money, and I'd open the door. And finally you'd have like 100 person club. There'd be like 250 people in it. Right, so, all $2 ahead, right? So,
and it's not like you could go out, you know, even if it was in the middle of the summer, you couldn't go out on the sidewalk and come back in, remember? Because it was always, the thing I remember more than anything was, "No ins or outs." You couldn't, it didn't matter if it was in the middle of, the middle of the summer, you know, there was nobody getting in and out of there for sure.
Yeah, and it stank. Well, I mean, hey, that's okay. The beer was $1.50, and it was $2 to get in, or $2.50, right?
Right. It was just fantastic. And, you know, yeah. I mean, from the time we were 18 to the time that we were 21, at least, I mean, we'd come up to see shows in Vancouver all the time. And, yeah. Of course, you could buy beers, but we didn't even drink back then, really. And then every time we did, you'd start drinking the High Test or, you know, one of those beers. And, you know, just it's like, we don't have any beer like this out here or down here. And it was just, you know, like just the weirdest scene as far as that goes. But
somehow it worked. Yeah, you're right. Because we combined the old ages. The hall shows were great. The hall shows didn't last very long because we'd usually use them once or twice. Then something would get wrecked, and then the hall people would like go like, "You're not coming back here." I remember one, that Arcadian Hall, you guys play with us, and people started throwing water all over the bands, like buckets of water over the floor. So it's like water on the stage, on the floor. And the guy I rented was this little Welsh guy. And he was looking for me afterwards because I'd always go rent the halls, and he'd go like afterwards he's looking for me. So I saw him and I put like an amp on my shoulder so he couldn't see my face. So I was trying to get away. They go, "Where's that Jill Keithley? Me grandmother can play better music than that." So I mean, the halls, because I'd go rent them, and they'd say, "Oh, what do we use for?" "Well, I put it on a dance for young people." They go, "Oh, would you like some chairs?" "No, I don't think the chairs would be a good idea because the chairs all suddenly become flying objects."
Yeah. The less you had in the area, the better. You know, like we do the hall shows down here, and we'd take all the chairs, and you know, we think we were doing a good job putting everything back like in the kitchen, and then closing the door and putting something in front of the thing and everything. And sometimes that worked. And, you know, like, I mean, you just think of it. It just seems like kids are a little better behaved these days than they were back then. I mean, it just seemed like, you know, people just go back in the kitchen and just smash a bunch of stuff, you know, for no reason. And it's like, well, you know, I understand that, you know, that urge to do stupid things, but you know, people don't seem like they do dumb shit like that anymore. And that's fine.
Yeah. I know, it's okay.
You know, here, like the hall shows, you know, run out whenever they did in 82 or whatever, people, you just run out of places to do them, and people wouldn't, you know, we know you're in a band. So you'd have somebody else go talk to the guy, because they were mostly little old guys, you know, just renting their hall, and that's you know that they had their meetings in. And you know, if you trashed it, then they wouldn't have a place for their thing, you know, whenever it was the next thing.
Self-preservation on the hall's part.
But you know, just think of going up, like, you know, constantly something at the Buddha, you know, something at the Commodore,
Yeah.
It was just great voice. It was really a great scene up there at the time when the Seattle scene, I mean, like by 1983 or 80, whatever it was, we had the Metropolis, which had shows every weekend. But before that, you know, there just wasn't. There was the Gorilla Room. The Gorilla Gardens didn't really start until a little bit later, 84 maybe.
Yeah, right.
So that crucial time there again, 1982, where, you know, everybody wanted something to happen and everybody was kicking at all the doors and trying to make something happen and regrouping and trying to find combinations of people that were gung-ho and trying to make things happen. And, you know, it was an uphill battle for us in Seattle at that time.
That gives evidence to the guys in the living, just like, you know, got to try something different. And he's playing all sorts of different instruments. So it's just like anything to try and, I'm going to do something creative. And so it's like, this is like a way to get at it. So, you know, and you know what, as I said before, this is a time when maybe a year after that, the whole scene, the original scene was kind of like, it wasn't completely done, but a lot of the old friends that were still hanging around previously, they weren't coming out anymore. You know, people had gone on and started doing different things, right? You know, I mean, I guess people would also like, you talk about changes that people got tired of, even if you were traveling, you got tired of like sleeping on the floor, but they're using a cat box as your pillow, right? So.
yeah, that's true. Like, I mean, you know, I guess it was probably, you know, well into the 80s, you know, that it's just like, are you just banging your head against the wall if something's not happening? And you do get tired of sleeping in the cat box. And it's like, well, and then you see some, you know, oh, well, this band has a label deal and they're sleeping in, you know, hotel rooms or Motel 6 or something like that.
At least not, yeah.
And you know, it was like, that would be deluxe, you know? And it's like, well, you know, sometimes if you had a day off and you didn't have a show, you'd sport for a Motel 6 room and everybody would cram into it. And, you know, but, you know, it was tough. It was pretty much a thankless job other than actually getting to play the shows and having fun and all that.
Yeah, that's the best part. You just hope your van didn't break down. You know, you made your way from town to town. You know, you're driving in some crummy old van, not getting paid, but having a great time doing it, right? I mean, that's a big, big, big reason why I kept playing all these years, right? It's just like, it's great to get up on stage and, you know, drive people crazy, right?
Yeah, for sure. It's the, you know, the payoff is full. The payoff is the thing.
Yeah. That's about the only thing.
Well, hopefully you're in a band with people that you like too.
Right.
When I know that's a tough thing, because anybody, even if you start out liking them, you know, being in a van, you know, for any amount of time is gonna take its toll. But if you didn't like them to begin with, like, people are always asking, you know, people ask me like, what do you recommend, you know, to people that are trying to start a band now, you know, to try to make things, you know, work okay. And it's, you know, play with people that you like and actually play music that you're really into. Like, you know, of course, back then, if somebody called you up and said, oh, do you want to play in this band, you know, that's going somewhere, that's actually doing something, and you have a chance to make a record that has a budget, and you have a chance to, you know, stay in a Motel 6 and, you know, not be, you know, stinky constantly, you know, of course, that would be a pretty big thing. And, you know, like, well, maybe it's worth playing music that I don't care about that much, or I don't really like these people, you know. But, you know, if you're 21 or 18 or 19 or whatever, you know, you're more likely to do something like that. And fortunately, I never had to do that. Like, everything that I did was with people that I liked, and for the most part, music that I liked. And but if you're playing music you like with people that you can at least tolerate, then it's hard to look back at it and think, you know, what was I doing? You know, you may have not got anywhere, but hopefully you will have made something that you're proud of, you know. And
I would say, I think that's a really good rule. DOA was always founded on friendship. People changed as we went, right? So, I mean, like, Randy left, Chuck left after a while, after 4 years, the kind of core group broke up. And we were still friends, but it was, the things had changed. We'd done an awful lot together over that time, and how fast we were going somewhere, then people go, we're not going, we're going somewhere, but we're not getting there fast. I think I can get there faster doing something else. So that happens, like people leave, but that's really good advice. Play with friends and play what you want, because like, if you play what you want and you keep working at it and getting better and better and better, this is usually what I tell young bands, is that sooner or later, somebody's going to go, wow, these guys are fucking great. It's like, even though the style might have got like retread around us, three or four times over the years. So what? If it's what you enjoy doing, I always say, when I see bands, it's kind of go, they follow like musical trends and keep going in flux. That's when they kind of lose their core. And we talked about that earlier, that if you want to play music that's 180 degrees different than what you started out with, then fine. But just give yourself, the band, a different name, right?
Right. Something different and go head on. That doesn't, it doesn't mean you have to stop your other thing too. You can just put it on hold, give something a try. And, I guess that's also what sort of what burned out so many bands in the 70s is, people didn't have the opportunity to take a break, even into the 80s and the 90s and whatnot, they were manager driven and they were, it's like, you got to keep going. And these poor, you think of, Humble Pie or some band in the 70s, it's like, did they ever get a week off? Was there ever any time to just sit around? It's like, nope, your tour is done, start working on your new record. Okay, we got to send you, you couldn't stay together, it's gonna blow up,
I think in the 1985 was our busiest year. We went to Europe, did a double circle around North America, and came back and toured Canada again after Europe. And I think we were on the road for like 300 days, 365. I was just like, and a bunch of equipment blew up, bands blew up. And we came back after that amount of time traveling, that many shows, and we came back flat broke. And we're just going like, and we've been going by 7 years by this point. We're just going like, what part of this is not working properly? this sucks, right?
Yeah. Of a year of, absolutely busting your butt.
just like hellacious, like playing, either playing or traveling every single day, right? So if we weren't playing that day, it's because the drive was too long. Right. So
yeah.
That's just like, couldn't physically get to the next town or whatever. Right.
Just thinking of some of the drives that people did back then. Oh yeah, don't worry, we can drive 10 hours, 12 hours, and drive right up to the club and unload and start playing. It's like, oh, cool.
Yeah, we did that lots of times. It's just like unbelievable where we'd arrive 10 minutes before we're supposed to be on. Right, we'd drive for like 16 hours. You're like, it's kind of like one speeding ticket or one flat tire away from missing the show.
from missing. Wow. Good. And what can you say? you spent 1985. 360 days, you said?
Yeah, and both the two vans blew up, so we lost a ton of money on both of them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I just left on that. The Vans actually kind of bankrupt the tour. We were doing okay until that happened. Then we're like, oh, okay, well, that didn't work out very well.
Yeah, you can always find a Marshall and a 412 cabinet pretty easy. Yeah, but, yeah. You know, to buy a van that'll drive, drive you around the world.
Yeah, it's like, it's tough to find a dependable one, right? So at one point there, Kurt, I was going to write a book. It was called My Friends, the Garage Mechanics of America, because I think I know every one of them, right? So.
Oh, man. I was also, I guess we kind of talked about the difference between the Vancouver music scene and the Seattle music scene of that time.
Yep.
And, as far as we knew, the Vancouver scene, you guys did, you had the DOA and the Subhumans. And I think the Pointed Six probably stopped in about 1980 or 81.
81, they had an... probably about 81, and they probably played a little bit into 82, maybe early 83, but very sporadically. Like the steam had totally gone out of it at that point.
Yeah, which seems weird now too, because that their album is absolutely killer. You'd think that, oh, we did this. Yeah. I guess they went to England and did the album that didn't actually come out, and came back and made a pop rock classic record, and then pretty much split up.
Yeah, if the one in England, because for people that don't know, the Pointed Six were kind of pop punk band that they got signed to Stiff Records, who put out The Damned and all sorts of people in the UK, like very successful. And they got this Nigel something or other who had produced The Police's first album. And so they got signed to this label. So they were going to be like the next big thing as far as like us people in Vancouver, where the West Coast of Canada went. And they got over there, did the record, and the label hated it and shelved it. And so they came back and did the same set of songs with Bob Rock in Vancouver. Right. So, but the momentum that they had from the beginning, 1980, and then not getting the album up by the end of 1980, just kind of took the steam out of it, and they were still a good, really good band, and they still had great songs, but it was just a really all of a sudden like, ugh, they hadn't fallen off a cliff, but it was just like, their drive that they'd had a couple years earlier was, I don't know what happened, but just like
kind of
fizzled.
The same as every band, really thought they were getting somewhere, and they were really had great songs and absolutely great band. And, we're going to go to England and make our, debut record, and it's going to be great. And then everything just sort of, it's like, oh, what are we doing? Banging our heads against the wall. We did all this stuff. We still haven't generated a dime. And, everybody likes our band, but, but fortunately.
Yeah, you can only get so far on people going, well, you guys are great. But then if you're not. You get to the point when people are getting a little bit older and think, oh, I've been playing for a while, we should be making a living, which is some of the points we've been making here. I mean, when the Pointed Six broke up, Chuck had quit, so Dimwit, who I'd grown up in high school with, had our high school bands, all of a sudden, he became the DOA drummer. And then we got Wimpy from the Subhumans. Mm-hmm. So we knew when Wimpy to play bass, when Randy was out, and we knew for sure that was the death knell for the Subhumans. Wimpy has stuck in there with them, but he was just go. So it was like, for us, it was like, it was old, like our old high school band, except now it was a different form. Yeah, we were terrible when we were 15 or 16, but now all of like we're 22, and we had our high school band back together again, but it was called DOA, right? So, for the second lineup right now. So,
yeah.
It was a weird thing, right? So.
And what a great lineup that was. Was that was going probably in 85. That was probably your
That would be 82 to 85. Dimwit on drums, Wimpy on bass, Dave on guitar, and me on guitar, right? So So Chuck and Randy left, and we picked up Wimpy and Dimwit. It's kind of like a hockey team. We they got released or they got traded. You know, we traded Chuck the Black Flag for $1,000, and Randy got cut on waivers and then got picked up by Annihilator. And we, you know, we drafted Wimpy and Dimwit from other bands, and you know, continued on our quest to try and win the Stanley Cup. Right, so it's a Canadian's dream.
And everybody knew all the songs anyway, so it's just
like, it's like yeah. I mean, some of them we'd written. We're playing stuff we'd written. We have a band called the Skulls in '77, our first punk rock band, and we're doing, you know, that's a bunch. That was some of the early mainstay DOA songs. We're back from then, you know. So be it. If they're good songs, we're playing them a few years later, right? So
yeah. You know, that was, I mean, I remember loving the original three piece. Well, I guess when we first saw you guys in 78, it was the first of your shows as a three piece. Is that right? I think, well, I read somewhere that Brad Kent stayed in San Francisco. He didn't make the trek up to Seattle or something.
Yeah, our first trip, our first road trip to the Mubuhe in San Francisco. We had two shows there. And I took a train. Chuck and Randy took a bus. And Brad hitchhiked down the, he had his Lust Wall in one hand, so a case, and hitchhiked down the I-5 from Vancouver to San Francisco. And got there late, just barely made the shows. And then he didn't get to the Seattle one. So, but we had been playing as a three-piece before that. But then all of a sudden, Brad wasn't there, so I went, oh crap, I gotta play guitar again. I kind of stopped playing for a little bit, right? And I remember being a little bit rusty at that show. And then after that show, me and Chuck said Brad was out, and Brad went and joined the Avengers. He liked hanging out in San Francisco and got into a great band, right? You know, so he was in the Avengers for maybe about the last 8 months of their existence. Yeah, I mean, I know they're reformed now, but original tenure. Yeah.
Back in the original days. Yeah.
Those guys were great. That was a great band.
Oh, for sure. I mean, we, you know, the Avengers would end up here definitely a few times in 1978. And
They were touring around. They were kind of like the first band to come up here, right? And and the first band that we opened for them in San Francisco, and people were going wild. The place was packed. And that was kind of like the band from the originals. I think they opened for the Sex Pistols.
I think they did the Sex Pistols. Yeah,
Winterland or whatever, you know, for that one tour the Pistols had. And they were the shit. Like there was that kind of the West Coast band. I mean, and really also like kind of before the LA scene really took off, even though there's like all sorts of elements of the LA scene, the Avengers kind of got, you know, fairly big prominence before that, right? You know, good records, good band, right?
And you know, it's just hard to imagine, you know, people now that, of course, there's internets and all kinds of other things, like how much actual work it was to get a band to that point, you know, because there weren't places to play all over the place. I mean, you had to, you know, you were almost like, you know, not to make it sound like you're, you know, an army of punk rockers or anything like that, but the places you end up playing were not necessarily places that normally had music like that, because you know, in 1978 there wasn't much music like that, and most of it was absolutely underground. So if you know, wanted to go to different cities, you know, you talk on the phone and maybe, you know, as you said, Chuck Tukowski, don't play there. You know, that's a bad idea. But, you know, it was, you were really going out on a limb. You're going into, it was like space travel or something. You know, you had no idea what you're getting.
It was like people crossing the United States in covered wagons, just the frontier. Exactly. Akin to that, right?
and certainly there were people that were absolutely hostile, you know, the holdouts for regular rock. It's like, we don't like punk rock. That's, you know, that's baloney, you know. And
we got in lots of fights with people that hated us, just like, you know, that walk by and they go, why are you trying to play some fucking rock with that thing? You know, I'd be carrying my guitar, right? You know? It's like, oh, fuck you. Like,
you're not just going to play punk, are you? You're going to play some real rock and roll with that. It's like,
you're going to play some Stones, are you? Right. So, I love the Rolling Stones, but that was what we were playing.
Right, right, right. And you know, that is sort of the funny thing to think about, you know, the early days is like people didn't just come out of the womb playing punk rock. You grew up, you know, with all kinds of music and you knew the kind of music that you didn't want to play, you know, was basically what everybody else was playing in, you know, at that time, you know, kind of easygoing bar rock. It's like, well, I just don't want to do that. There's tons of other stuff that's great, but just, you know, you just want to do something exciting, you know, either fast or loud or both, you know, and you just, it's not like everybody hated every other kind of music, you know, so, and it took probably until, I was thinking like in around 1982 or so, like, you remember, like, you know, people would go to the hall shows and it's like, you know, it's either punk or you suck and stuff. And you know, if you liked Van Halen or you liked AC/DC, you know, people are, oh, that sucks. You suck. You know, and like right around that time, you know, probably there was enough new people listening to music that, you know, it's like, well, it's not all that much different. You know, some music's faster, slower, but it's all fine. And thinking that was probably what happened to some of these bands is like, oh, well, it's, you don't have to play only hardcore music, or you can, you know, you can, you, it's okay to have, you know, some guitar solos in your songs. You don't have to, and you know, because even when we were starting, it's like, well, we're just playing as best we can and trying to make cool songs, and you know, people throw shit at us, and you know, it's like, why are you throwing stuff at us, you know? But by about 1982, I always consider that the year that people sort of decided that maybe Motorhead was a band that sort of united a bunch of people. It's like, well, they're not, you know, they're kind of metal and they're kind of hard rock and they're kind of punk, you know. It's like, oh, well, so you can like the Ramones and AC/DC and Van Halen and Cheap Trick, you know, it's all fine. There's all, you know, you don't have to hate everything and you don't have to negate everything. And you know, so maybe that's.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I was like, that it, at first people were just, you had to, I think that's why younger people are different today, because when I grew up, your music was, you like these types of music and everything else, like you said, that all sucked. Everything was in kind of like a silo type thing. And everything outside of that was just, oh, well, you're an idiot, right? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but I think kids today, they can listen to everything, right? So it's,
right, and it's a lot different than that. If you didn't grow up then, you know, you can listen to all music, and people, I talk to, you know, younger people are like, oh yeah, I found this band, Sir Lord Baltimore, you know, they're cool. Were they, you know, did you like them when you're little? It's like, you know, that these bands that weren't, you know, weren't popular, but nobody knows now what was actually popular and what wasn't. So they just listen to the music that they like, and it's awesome, but also really weird.
Well, I remember like what got us in the punk rock, the bands. I remember really specifically bands I heard all the time as a high school I hated were like Pablo Cruz and Fleetwood Mac. I didn't like, and didn't like Foghat, even though some people would like him for like a hard rock perspective, but that was kind of the backdrop, that there wasn't like a lot of like crazy, weird rock. It kind of like died out. Like, I remember, like, you mentioned AC/DC. I've been playing in DOA for a couple of years, and finally a friend of mine, probably about 1980, says, have you heard of these AC/DC guys? I said, no. He says, oh, well, they're kind of like punks from Australia. I went like, really? They put the record on. I went, that's not punk rock, but it's really good. You know what I mean? Like these guys,
no,
it's kick ass, right? Yeah.
it's like, you know, maybe like the Rolling Stones played through a MXR Distortion Plus or something. You know, it's like, it, you know, just it's rock and roll, but it's, yeah, you know, it's yeah, next level rock and roll, which is all we were looking for, is something, you know, that was a little more exciting. Like you mentioned Pablo Cruz. It's like, you know, it's just like,
terrible.
We don't know what we want to play, or we just know what we don't want to do, you know?
Yeah, and that was they were a prime example. Or Boss Skaggs.
Yeah, just easy, you know, easygoing, you know, light groovy music was just like the worst. And and also the bar bands that, you know, we weren't going to bars then, but, you know, you'd go, all the bands that you'd hear about were all just kind of regular rock. And it's like, no, you know, we don't want to be like that. We want to do anything but that.
And, yeah, I mean, but that's when people heard the Ramones, like we saw them, they came to Vancouver in early 77, I think, and they played the Commodore, a whole 1,200 people. They had sold two tickets, so they made it a free show. I guess it's probably 76, maybe late 76. And about 100 people showed up. That was the only people that ever heard of the Ramones. And then we watched that. They played about a half hour, just played the first album, start to finish. And at the end, we all looked at each other and went like, oh, so that's what punk rock is. Because we'd see it on TV or read about it.
There was a TV, like ABC TV news report of British punk rock. And we're like,
whoa, we see the Damned or the Pistols on TV. But we saw the Ramones one, like, that's how you actually play it. That's how you perform it. And that was, like, so kick-ass that we couldn't believe it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, seeing the Ramones, you know, pretty much changed everything.
Yeah, they were, like, the best, if you ask me, right? So, like, hey, Kurt, I should probably get going.
Okay.
Yeah, I got to get down to City Hall, believe it
or not. Oh, that's right. Yeah, you're done with the Zoom meetings now. You're actually going to in-person meetings.
Like, exactly, right? So, yeah. No, great talk today. I don't know if there's anything we missed out, right? But
let's see. Let me see if there's something that they'd sent. I think that all the other things are things that I can just say myself, the intros and the outros. And that I'm just, you know, but you know, I think we got some good, I think we got some good shit here.
Okay, good. And great seeing you. And glad to help out. This is lots of fun. Anytime you get to talk about the real good old days, and they were like a ton of fun, right?
Absolutely.
I always have a blast.
And right? we're very lucky to still be talking about them. And
And knock on wood, and here's all our friends. They're not around anymore. I miss them all, right? So, but this, you know, we're still here. So, yep.
So crank up the guitar at your next available opportunity, and have a good rest of your day.
Okay. Thanks, sir. Okay. Take care.
Thanks, Joe.
All right.
Talk to you later.
Yep. Bye now.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Living 1982 podcast. Circle back for weekly episodes and find out about each week's special guests and where to stream the music by following the band's release on Instagram at the Living 1982.